two novels set during World War II from very different sides of the story.
They were looking everywhere for visas. They were searching desperately for a country that would take them. But by 1938, only three countries in the world were still granting visas to Jewish refugees wanting to flee the Nazis. And that was Bolivia, the Dominican Republic, and Japan-occupied Shanghai. And my family managed to get visas to Bolivia eventually. So it wasn't a choice to go there. It was the only place that would take them.
That's Jennifer Style. And the family she references is the fictional family of her wonderful novel, Exile Music. Then, a rare depiction of the war from the point of view of an ordinary German family as their lives and society crumble around them.
The setting is in a small town in northern Bavaria, which is in the south of Germany. It takes place over the last 6 months or so of the war. So, you know, it's already clear that defeat is imminent. And yet the Germans are still being urged to fight for every square inch of their land to keep it safe from both the Allies coming in from the west and also from the Soviets coming in from the east.
That's Annette Binder. We talk with her about her powerful novel, The Vanishing Sky. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. When Nazi Germany annexed Austria in 1938, it was the beginning of the end of Austria's Jews. Vienna had been home to a flourishing Jewish community with many illustrious figures active in literature, science, and the arts. Among those were some members of the famed Viennese Philharmonic Orchestra under the direction of Bruno Walter, who was also Jewish. When the Nazis marched in, those musicians lost their jobs, and most of them lost their lives unless they were able to emigrate somewhere else. The problem was, almost no country would take them in. But Bolivia did. In her novel, Exile Music, Jennifer Style tells a story of a family that flees Vienna for safe harbor in the mountains of Bolivia. It centers around a young girl, Orly, daughter of two musicians with the Viennese Philharmonic, as she struggles with the traumas of loss and war and eventually adapts to her new homeland. It's a fascinating look at a little-known corner of World War II history, with salient lessons for our current global refugee crisis. Jennifer Style, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
This novel, Exile Music, is a wonderful read, very powerful. It's a story of a family, a Jewish family, who have to flee Austria when it's taken over by the Nazis. Now, you did an enormous amount of research into this period. This is based on a real history. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, we found out about the particular population of refugees in Bolivia when we were living there. I lived in La Paz, Bolivia, with my husband and our young daughter for 4 years. And my husband came home from work one night, having talked to the Austrian consul, and said, "Did you know that during World War II, there were more than 10,000 Jewish refugees living here, many of whom were musicians and artists?" And I hadn't been aware of that particular population in Bolivia. And I soon thereafter met the son of one of these refugees, and he introduced me to a lot of other people. And then, as you mentioned, I've done years of research in all kinds of places. But in 1938, when my family that I write about is trying to escape Vienna, there are only three countries in the world still accepting Jews, still granting visas to Jews.
And now tell us about this family. We'll go more into that history of Bolivia, but tell us about the family themselves in Austria. Let's start there.
Okay, so my main character, Orly, is around 10 years old when the book starts, and her father is a viola player with the Vienna Philharmonic, and her mother is an opera singer. And Orly grows up around music her whole life. She's born into music, and music is how her parents fell in love with each other. It's how they communicate. It's how their family relates to each other. Her mother sings to her every night. Music is their language. And when the Vienna Philharmonic expels all of its Jewish musicians, Orly's father loses his job. Her mother is no longer getting work as an opera singer because she's Jewish. And so they start frantically looking for a way out. And I became very interested in what the Vienna Philharmonic did to its Jewish musicians, because none of them ever came back. Most of them died. And the Vienna Philharmonic continued to employ Nazis even after the war. And Orly's father would have played along. I mean, he's fictional, but based on actual musicians. And they would have been playing right alongside people who wished for their deaths, which must have been pretty difficult.
Yes. In fact, I think something like half. I was inspired by your book to do a little reading in that. And even before the Nazis came in, something like half of the members of the orchestra were Nazi sympathizers.
That's right. And there was, I think it's Hermann Wobisch, the trumpeter, who he was still working with the Vienna Philharmonic until 1967, I think. And the Philharmonic, it's an interesting organization. They didn't even admit women until pretty recently. So they're not the most forward-thinking organization, to put it mildly.
Right. Yeah, and I think you really express the kind of terror, the building of terror for Jews in Austria, even before the Nazis march in, but then they march in. I mean, I think Austria was annexed pretty early, certainly before war broke out. And you really express it with incredible verisimilitude, what it was like. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what the family experienced and how they felt about that.
Well, it was a bit like living in a tightening noose. Orly's relatives, her grandmother anyway, was quite politically active, and her brother was also politically active, and they were much more aware of what was going on than her parents were. And her parents were so enveloped in their musical world that they didn't really realize or become fully aware of what was going on until the Anschluss, when Austria was absorbed into Germany. And they first lost their apartment. Their apartment was taken by a Christian family, and they were forced to live in an apartment in a historically Jewish neighborhood in Vienna with many other families. They kind of stuffed them all into these apartments together, and there were so many places they weren't allowed to go. I mean, they weren't allowed to sit on benches or go to shops or they were being slowly starved. And then after Kristallnacht, it was really crystal clear that they were not going to survive if they stayed in Austria. And they were looking everywhere for visas. They were searching desperately for a country that would take them. But by 1938, only three countries in the world were still granting visas to Jewish refugees wanting to flee the Nazis. And that was Bolivia, the Dominican Republic, and Japan-occupied Shanghai. And my family managed to get visas to Bolivia eventually. So it wasn't a choice to go there. It was the only place that would take them.
You know, and you speak of them, and this is how the book is also written. It was so real that there were times when I forgot that it was a novel, and I thought it was a memoir.
Well, that's good. I suppose that's what I set out to do, is to create a real, I mean, that's the reason for doing so much research, is you want anyone who lived through this time to look at the book and the environment that these characters live in and find it recognizable. So even though my story is completely fictional, my characters are made up, Their whole world is informed by research, and even parts of their personal story is informed by research, by interviews I did with people who lived through this. So, yeah, I guess that was my goal, to make it feel real and alive, because I've never read anything about the Jewish refugees in Bolivia. There's a lot written about refugees in the U.S. and those who survived in Europe and other places, and other places in South America, but I've never read anything about the Jewish refugee community in Bolivia other than memoirs and personal accounts. And I read a ton of memoirs and a ton of personal accounts. A lot of people publish their memoir, they self-publish their memoir, largely so their family would have a record of what happened to them. And so I read a lot of those, and they were fascinating.
And so why did Bolivia take in the refugees? It seems like an odd choice given the right-wing bent of the government.
Yes. Well, the president at the time, Hermann Busch, he had a German parent. And so he was asked by Hochschild, there was a mining baron who they call him the South American Schindler, because he managed to get Bolivia to accept all these Jewish refugees. And what Bolivia did was, I mean, he basically said to the government, look, you could make these refugees do agricultural work and they could help your economy. And so that was the pitch that was made to the government at the time. And so a lot of these Jews were sent out to live in the jungle to create these agricultural colonies and grow coffee and fruit in the jungle. And these colonies were a failure. The Jewish people who were urban Viennese people and from elsewhere in Europe, they weren't farmers. They had no experience growing things. And they also had none of the natural immunities to the diseases of tropical Bolivia. And so a lot of them died, and crops failed, and it just, the population dwindled pretty rapidly. So a lot of Jews, even though they were admitted on agricultural visas, chose to stay in La Paz because they were able to find work there. And some of them were able to pursue their professions depending on what they were.
And La Paz, of course, is high in the Andes, so the diseases were not so prevalent, but it was still a challenge because the refugees were not used to the lack of oxygen, of higher levels of oxygen.
That's true. I lived in La Paz for 4 years, and I found it quite challenging to live at altitude. Everything takes longer to heal. I mean, mosquito bites would take 3 months to go away. Just everything's different without oxygen. Your digestion's different. You start running up the stairs and suddenly realize that you have to take it more slowly. And so these refugees were largely from sea level cities, and suddenly they are at 12,000 feet in the middle of the Andes. And it was quite an adjustment physically, aside from the cultural adjustment and the fact that they didn't speak Spanish or any of the indigenous languages. There was just nothing there that they recognized.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jennifer Style about her novel, Exile Music. It's the story of a young girl who flees to Bolivia with her family after the Nazis annex Austria in 1938. You know, we live in a time where we have a refugee crisis as well. And there are some who are saying that this is going to get exacerbated, in fact, by the growing food crisis that is coming about as a result of the pandemic and other factors that are caught up with it. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your reflections as you were writing the story. What were you feeling? What kinds of associations, if any, did you make with what's going on here and your thoughts about that?
Well, I think there are a lot of contemporary resonances because there's so many refugees all around the world right now, and there's such an discrimination against them. I mean, in our country, we have a lot of countries closing their borders to refugees. And so I think a lot about the plight of these people who you know, they didn't choose to become refugees. No one chooses to become refugees. These are people who are in untenable situations. They're people coming from conflict or famine. And so I think, you know, there's anyone who's been a refugee, you know, I just think that the story of this family is also a contemporary story. So many people these days are being forced from their homes and having to find, you know, Syrian refugees for one, who, you know, are finding themselves in foreign countries and perhaps camps and trying to survive and make a life for themselves. So there's many parallels.
Yes. Yes, there are. Now, I want to ask you a little bit about Orly's older brother in the book. Her older brother, Willie,
right,
does not go with them to Bolivia. He ends up getting involved with saving Jewish children in France, where he has he tried to flee to Switzerland and ended up in France. So here you intersect the story with something that really happened. Tell us about that.
So Willie, his escape from Austria, he swims across a river to Switzerland, and that's actually based on a story one refugee told me about someone who actually, his brother actually swam to Switzerland, and so that's where I got that bit of Willie's history. And then Willie has always been political. He was always one of the most active political members of their family. And so when he finds an organization that's actually doing something to help Jewish children, and he realizes he could, there's something he could do. I mean, he can't go to war, but he could help the French underground. And so he ends up getting involved with this organization, the OSCE, that placed children in various safe houses all around France and other countries. It was originally founded in Russia to help Jewish children. So while he's doing that work, actually, you don't find out that he's been doing this work till close to the end of the book, but he meets other people while he's doing this work with whom he forms close relationships. I don't want to give away too much more about what happens to him, but he's very passionate about helping these children, and that's why he doesn't rejoin his family in Bolivia. I think he feels that to go join his family and just flee to safety would be giving in or giving up, and he wants to do something to fight back against the Nazis. Of course, the mother in Bolivia has her own little war against the Nazis once they show up in Bolivia.
Yeah, she does. You know, you pose a number of different ethical questions or dilemmas in the book, and with Willie, it's one that I've often asked myself. As my listeners know, my father was involved in the Dutch underground during the war. And I've often wondered if I could have done what he did. You know, he sheltered a Jewish man in his apartment for 3 years. He was a courier for the resistance. I'm not sure I really could. And Willie, you know, makes a choice. I mean, we find out he even had a visa or could have had a visa to Bolivia, but he decides against it. He stays in France. He risks his life for these children. I wonder how you might have interrogated yourself, your own thoughts on if you could have done what he did.
Well, I don't think any of us actually know how we would behave in a situation like that until we're in it. There was a book I read as part of my research called Les Parisiennes. It's in English. It just has that French title. But it was a story of the Jewish women in the resistance and Jewish women who weren't in the resistance and what women were doing during the war in France. And it was a really interesting book because it was a lot about the gray area, about how, you know, some people chose to collaborate with the Nazis and some chose to work for the resistance. And then there were people who were kind of in between. And I mean, a lot of what I took away from that book was we just don't know what we would do if we were put in the situations a lot of these people were put in. There were people put in impossible situations where there wasn't really a good decision for them to make. And some people chose to collaborate or to continue to perform in a cabaret, for example, for Nazis, rather than risk their lives or their career. People made choices for their own survival, and whereas some people made choices for other people's survival. And I think it's pretty hard to know. I mean, I would like to think, I think we'd all like to think that we would do the noble and brave thing. But I think until you're in a situation, until you face the decisions that all these people had to make, and there were so many really tough calls people had to make with their lives, that it's just hard to know.
Yeah, and another ethical dilemma is you talk in the book about how after the war, a lot of Nazis, ex-Nazis, went to South America, including Bolivia. In fact, you mentioned Klaus Barbie, the butcher of Lyon, who ended up finally in the 1980s being extradited to France to stand trial, but, you know, lived a nice, happy life in Bolivia for quite a long time after the war. And one of the characters in the book is engaged in a project of revenge. Let's just leave it at that. What led you to introduce this element into the book? Is this based on something that actually happened, or just the story itself led you there?
The story itself led me there. It's not based on anything that actually happened. I was thinking about this because my friend John Galanta, who was the first, he was the son of refugees from Poland. He was born right after his parents moved to La Paz, and he ran into Klaus Barbie on the street in La Paz, and his former wife ran into Klaus Barbie in La Paz as well, and he tried to speak to her children, and I just started to imagine what that must have been like. You flee Austria, you think you're finally safe, and then this horror that you fled suddenly shows up basically on your doorstep in your refuge, and how difficult that must have been to deal with, and how, if you knew who Klaus Barbie was, and it seems that everyone in the Jewish refugee community did know who he was, it would be quite tempting to want to do away with him. And I think I myself would be tempted to do away with him were I in that situation. And so I think, you know, Orly, when she discovers this character's ideas about or what she's doing, you know, she has her own conflicting feelings, because of course she doesn't mourn the death of Nazis, but at the same time, does she want to make herself a killer? Because if you become a killer, are you not becoming like them in a way?
Yeah, exactly. This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Jennifer Style about her novel Exile Music. Now, I don't want to end this interview without exploring another thread in the book, which is Orly's discovery of her love for women, as well as, you know, she ultimately actually marries a man who she loves very much. So I wonder if you could talk about how you explored this theme and also what led you to her decision to get married.
Well, I did a lot of research when I created her relationship with Annalisa. I mean, they're still quite young. They're 11 when they say goodbye to each other, but they had such an intense and passionate relationship. And they used to joke when they were young that someday, you know, they'd get married, you know, when they were young enough to not know that two girls couldn't get married. And I think as she grew up in La Paz, she wondered if maybe there was something more to that relationship than a friendship. And it's only after she reads a book that I read as part of my research called The Scorpion, which is a lesbian novel that talks about life in the gay underground in Germany at the time. And it was a fascinating book because I think we have a tendency to whitewash the sexuality of the past and to think, oh, people were more prim and proper back then. But they weren't. They were all having sex, and they were, you know, hiding it or keeping it under wraps. But people were having sex with each other. Women were having sex with each other. And when Orly reads this book, she recognizes herself in it. She recognizes the way she feels about a friend of hers she meets in Bolivia. She ends up falling in love with a girl in Bolivia later in her life. And that book is validation for her. And then she also hears another character say, oh, well, my aunt was like this. And then, I mean, today it's pretty impossible to be openly gay in Bolivia. Gay people have been killed for being gay in Bolivia. And so back in the day Orly was living there, it would have been even worse. in such a conservative society, there's no way she could have openly had a relationship with a woman. She certainly couldn't have made a life with a woman unless she'd been incredibly secretive about it. And so I won't get into how she loses the girl that she's in love with, but I think essentially Orly is, while she's mostly drawn to girls and women when she grows up, she is, I guess, what we would call bisexual, though I never use that word. And the man she eventually marries is someone who she does love passionately, first as a friend, and that passion takes a different route. They're close friends for such a very long time that he becomes a home to her. And I think that's, well, I don't want to give away exactly what happens in the end, but I think that's a large part of the draw, is in making a home in Bolivia, she's also made a home in her relationship with him. And so while she also has loves women, perhaps will always be drawn to women, she does end up marrying a man. I don't think she would have had much of a choice back then. I think she would have been expected to get married.
And so finally, this book is about people who have suffered and suffer through terrible losses and trauma. One of the characters, after recounting what she had witnessed during the war, for example, a man who threw a little girl off a roof in Vienna, asks Orly, knowing that we are capable of all that, how do we go on? This is really the question. I mean, we live in a time of such, perhaps all times are like this, but it seems to be getting worse, you know, of such terrible cruelty. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, how do we go on in this? What inspires you? What do you want to leave readers of this beautiful, beautiful book, Exile Music, with?
I think my characters wrestle with a lot of the same things I wrestle with. I don't think I have any answers about how we go on. Some people can't go on. There were many Holocaust survivors who did commit suicide because they couldn't find a way to go on. And yet some people did. Some people did go on. And that bit about the girl being thrown from the roof is based on something that did actually happen in the town in Poland where my friend John's mother came from. She gave very explicit and horrifying testimony that is in a Holocaust museum in Israel. And I read through her entire testimony, and it was among the most horrifying and difficult things I've ever had to read. And John, her son, has never been able to read all of her testimony because he just can't get through it. And he said, I talked to him last week, actually, several times, and he said that his mother, who'd been through this and who'd watched people murder children right in front of her, she never spoke of what happened to her during the war, never. For his entire life in Bolivia, did she ever mention it? And I think one way people coped is they just buried it. And another way people coped is they found things to hold on to, like a love or a child or the way the sun looks on a leaf. I mean, there's just, I don't know. I struggled with these things myself. Like, how do we go on knowing what we're capable of with the cruelty that we witness? And my characters wrestle with that too. And they, most of them do eventually find a way to go on. And a lot of what they rely on is music and the arts. And music is, Orly's family communicates in music. It's they use music to adapt to their new surroundings. Her father would die without music. He learns Bolivian music because that's how he relates to his new environment. That's how he adapts. It's a way to connect his past with his present and a way to create a future for himself. And Orly is more like him in that way. And she uses poetry to help bond her to life, I suppose. I think she, because of the effect of her mother's grief and depression on her, she doesn't want to fall into that black hole. She wants to find things to cling to. Because she's the youngest, when the family comes to Bolivia, she's the one who's most flexible and adaptable and who binds herself the most tightly to Bolivia.
Well, it is just a beautiful book, Exile Music. Jennifer Style, it's been a privilege to talk with you about this wonderful novel. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
In addition to Exile Music, Jennifer Style is the author of a memoir, The Woman Who Fell from the Sky, and the novel The Ambassador's Wife. Jennifer Style is married to an ambassador, the British ambassador to Uzbekistan. You can hear a sample of Exile Music being read or read an excerpt by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, another novel of World War II, this time from the perspective of a German family in the waning months of the war. Stay tuned after the break. And for the break, let's listen to a clip from Wagner's Die Walküre, played by the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra in 1935 under the direction of Bruno Walter. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I invite you to sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. So what was it like for ordinary German civilians to go through crushing defeat in the waning months of World War II? It's a perspective American readers seldom get to contemplate. Annette Binder's parents were children during that time, but the experience left a searing mark of trauma on her father's life, a teenager then, as well as profoundly impacting her mother, who was much younger. Drawing on family recollections and archival research for inspiration, in her novel The Vanishing Sky, Binder has crafted an intimate, harrowing story about a family of German citizens during World War II and the choices we make for country and for family. The Vanishing Sky is her first novel. Annette Binder, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca.
This novel, The Vanishing Sky, is unusual because it focuses on the war experience of a German family during World War II. And, you know, outside of memoirs or historical works, I have never really seen in English, I certainly haven't seen a novel that portrays this side of the story. And I think it's really a pity that it has taken so long. And I think you have done amazingly well in portraying what it was like to be, you know, a rural working class family in Germany at the end of World War II. Tell us a little bit about the setting and the time of this story.
Well, the setting is in a small town in northern Bavaria, which is in the south of Germany. It takes place over the last 6 months or so of the war. So, you know, it's already clear that defeat is imminent, and yet the Germans are still being urged to fight for every square inch of their land to keep it safe from both the Allies coming in from the west and also from the Soviets coming in from the east.
And it's told in a very close-up way. The focus is on this family, Etta, Josef, Max, and Georg Huber. Tell us a little bit about them.
Well, they are a family in this small town. The father, Josef, is the head school teacher in the small town, and the mother, Etta, is a devoted mother to her two sons. The elder son, Max, has been fighting on the Eastern Front and has been sent home early, much to Etta's relief. Her relief turns to dismay pretty quickly when she realizes that Max is not the same young man now that he was when he left for the front. And as his mental deterioration becomes ever more severe, she struggles to hide his condition from the authorities because she knows that they'll be taking him from her if they find out how sick he really is. At the same time, Etta and Josef's younger son, Georg, who's only 15, has been sent to a Hitler Youth Academy where he really struggles to fit in because he's just a chubby young man who doesn't really fit the ideal of the Reich in terms of his physicality and his mental outlook. And he falls in love with another Hitler Youth boy at this academy. And when the boy that he's in love with is killed in fighting, Georg takes a leap and runs away from his post and tries to make his way back home to his mother.
Now, tell us a little bit more about the circumstances of these two sons, Max, sent to the Eastern Front. What would he have experienced in the Eastern Front? We're talking about, you know, I think he's even, is he part of the siege of Stalingrad? Or
he saw fighting there, yes. Yes, he would have seen absolutely brutal fighting where Wehrmacht soldiers were often ordered to kill civilians, civilians that they labeled partisans and sort of just shoot them and let their bodies fall into trenches. So he would have seen terrible fighting. He would have seen the sort of turn against the German military and the sort of pushback as the Germans are forced to retreat back into German territory. And it was enough in his case to break him. That combined with some other sort of tendencies already, I think was enough to sort of break his spirit and cause a complete breakdown.
You know, one of the pervading themes of this book is the sense of loss, of the loss of potential, certainly of Max, who was a very different kind of person before he went through this trauma of being a soldier in one of the most brutal fronts of one of the most brutal wars we've seen in modern history. Could you elaborate a little bit on that, you know, the before and the after and that kind of theme of loss that runs throughout the book?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. The sort of loss of potential, an entire generation lost. And it's something that resonates on a deeply personal level with me because both my parents were German and my father was required to serve in the Hitler Youth. He was born in 1930, so he would have been 14 going on 15 right at the end of the war, the same age as Georg. And, you know, I see that sort of loss of potential in my father's own life trajectory. I mean, he was in school, he was studying hard, he was then forced to participate in the Hitler Youth. And, you know, family lore has it, he also walked away from his post near the end of the war. But his life was absolutely shattered after that. The schools were destroyed. That whole generation of young men and young women, to some extent as well, who were indoctrinated so completely and then left with a country in ruins and forced to grapple with what had happened. You know, his life was not the same. And it was something that I think he carried with him his entire life, although he never talked about it. So I think that was really on my mind as I was writing, sort of the loss, what a waste it was.
Yeah, and did he ever talk about it with you? Because you said family lore, so it sounds like you didn't talk about it with him.
He did not. My dad passed away when I was 16, and it was before I really had the presence of mind to ask him any questions about his life. And so everything I found out about him, I found out after he had passed away.
And you used sources from him, derived from him. Is that right? Was it a diary or what was it?
I had photographs. As a matter of fact, it was a photograph of him in his Hitler Youth uniform taken in 1944 that really got me going with the book. And then I also had family journals from my great-grandfather, my father's grandfather, that sort of talked about the period between the wars that were very helpful. And then my mother, who was probably more helpful than anyone, because she told me after his passing, she told me what my father had told her about his own childhood.
Now, was she also German?
Yes, my mother is also German, younger than my dad. So she would have only been almost five at the end of the war. But she also shared some of her memories, her very, very early memories of the surrender and of the American troops coming through her town. So I basically spent many hours chatting with my mom, learning everything I could, looking at whatever primary sources I could for my own family. And then after that, I just went to fiction to fill in the gaps.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, one of the things that also is so interesting, you know, we have all the novels from the other side of people who were persecuted by the Nazis or fighting the Nazis in war, in the resistance. You come from a perspective of people who have a kind, as you say, enforced conformity with the Nazi ideology, with Hitler's ideas, and yet doubts creep in very strongly. And I wonder if you could talk about what it must have been like to hold these doubts, in fact, even more than doubts, actual, you know, resistance to these ideas, and yet be enthralled to them because it was so dangerous to go against them.
Exactly. I mean, I think the idea that heroism can sometimes happen on a very small scale, sometimes it doesn't happen at all, and that people in these extremely difficult circumstances sometimes don't rise up, don't resist, don't comport themselves in a way that, you know, anyone could call heroic, and yet they still find ways to maybe resist on a very small scale. Maybe they don't resist at all. And what is life like in that case? What is it like to suspect something and yet try to rationalize it away so that in your mind, you know, perhaps that something terrible has happened to the Jews in town, to the Roma, to people who have disabilities or mental illness, to know in your heart that this is what's happening, but to try to rationalize it away in your head. And that sort of fundamental tension is something that I think comes up again and again with the characters. And there are moments of insight and then it gets pushed away. There are moments of resistance for some characters and not for others. I think, you know, the German population wasn't monolithic in the war. Not everyone risked life and limb to save people. Some people believed fervently in the Nazi ideology. Some people were nationalistic and didn't want the Soviets to invade, but had real doubts about Hitler. And other people knew what was going on, knew it was wrong, and still failed to resist. So the terrain is complicated. And in the story, I tried to capture some of that.
Yeah, and Etta, the mother, really finds her way to resistance through her love for her sons. I mean, she is a tiger. She will do anything to help them. Now, Georg, she's lost contact with for much of the book, but, you know, her son Max, she will leave no stone unturned to help him and to keep him from being exterminated, basically, because of his mental illness. I wasn't quite sure if that was something that he was at risk of.
Absolutely, yes. She will risk everything to save him because she knows what the stakes are. And that once he gets sent to the psychiatric clinic, he is at great risk of being killed.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Annette Binder about her novel, The Vanishing Sky. Based partly on her own family's experiences, it's about a German family in the last months of World War II. And also a very interesting portrait of her husband. You know, the story really depicts the patriarchy but also the sense of helplessness that her husband has. I mean, this is a story that's very much from the point of view of Etta and her younger son, Georg. They are the lens that we're looking at. But I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about Josef and the position that he's in as an older man in Germany, kind of losing it a little bit as well.
Yes, losing it, losing any sense of significance, and desperately trying. I think a nationalist, a German nationalist at heart, and trying to play some sort of role in protecting the country from what he thinks of as imminent invasion.
Imminent invasion. I mean, when we're talking about the Soviet influx, I mean, of course, they would have feared invasion from anyone, you know, and the American troops have been portrayed as better than the Soviet troops in the way they treated the local population. But that wasn't always true. But the Soviets were really famous for their campaign of rape, and they had a lot of reason to hate the Germans with a passion because of the brutality that had been practiced on them.
Yes, exactly. And when you look at the newsreels, the German newsreels from the era, I mean, the absolute hatred of the Bolsheviks is much, much stronger than the disdain that the Germans had for the British and the American forces. And it's rooted in both a sort of racial sense of difference and also an ideological disdain for Bolshevism. But it's a very noticeable feature in almost all of the newsreels, starting in like 1944, 1945 through, you know, March of 45 through the very final ones. And so I think that is something that the German population as a whole really, really feared more than anything.
And feared with reason.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, I think this is one of the things that you do so well in the book. You know, I think Western American audiences are conditioned to feel no sympathy for Germans who lived during that period. You show the human condition, the brutality and the horror of war that affects anyone who is in it without in any way excusing the crimes of Nazism.
Yes, and it's a, you know, I mean, absolutely. I think trying to show ordinary Germans in that circumstance, it's a fine line, because obviously what was happening and what had happened in Germany and in Europe at large is horrible beyond description. And trying to show ordinary Germans at the end of the war in a way that does not somehow diminish the horror of what the German regime had done, I think is a challenge. And it was something that I was mindful of as I was writing and as I was revising.
Could you talk a little bit more about that challenge?
You know, for me, everything that I write always starts with the characters. And so I sort of had to inhabit this family, and in particular, the mother Etta and the younger son Georg, since the story goes back and forth between those two points of view. And once I felt at ease with this family and I started to write, I really had to think as I was writing about not writing an apology, like an apologia for the horrors of the Reich. And it was a constant balancing act that I was only able, I think, to sort of work my way through by focusing on the family, focusing on the horror of Etta facing the loss of her own son, and realizing that the ordinary Germans who weren't complicit and who weren't true believers were victims of the regime too, obviously not on the same scale and the same magnitude as the Jewish victims and as the other victims of the genocide, but they suffered in a different way and in a way that's worth exploring and worth visiting now. And I'm grateful that I think more books are coming out now that talk about that aspect of it.
This is a small town, but there is some action that takes place in a larger city. And I think a lot of people are unaware of the fact that German cities were firebombed. And what firebombing means, you know, there was Dresden, there's Hamburg. You have a description as well one of the cities being firebombed. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what firebombing was as opposed to, you know, maybe like the London Blitz.
Firebombing was the sort of sustained effort to bombard German urban civilian centers in order to break the German spirit. And these targets, the ones that you'd mentioned, Dresden, Hamburg, but there were many, many more, including Würzburg, which is the city in my book, were often just purely civilian targets. They did not have a lot of industry, did not have a lot of infrastructure, but it was a deliberate effort to sort of break the German spirit and try to end the war. And it was both the Royal Air Force, the British, and also the Americans participated in it. Würzburg was a city on the Main River that was devastated in March of 1945 as part of this effort. And, you know, a lot of times the areas that were hardest hit were the sort of civilian residences, which were half timbered. And as a result of being half timbered and because of the sort of incendiary bombs used, you had basically just a firestorm that destroyed everything in its path. I mean, it would melt metal. It would incinerate people. You know, it was a catastrophe on a scale that is hard even to imagine. Max Sebald has a very good description of what the firebombing is like and what the aftermath of it was like in some of his essays. And, you know, it probably did succeed in ending the war sooner. I think there are some questions about whether it was the right thing to do, even at the time. I think it's very hard to second guess things like that, because, of course, even as these cities were being firebombed and civilians, you know, women and children and the elderly were being killed, the Reich was still going on with its extermination programs of people with mental illness and other disabilities. And so, you know, it's hard to say whether that actually hastened things, whether that saved lives. Those are such difficult decisions. And in retrospect, you know, maybe things would have been done differently, but it was definitely a tactic used by the Allies in order to hasten the end of the war and hopefully save lives, including their own soldiers' lives.
Well, that was the same rationale for the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And
actually, exactly.
Yeah. And the impact, other than the radiation, is not all that different with firebombing. And, you know, it has turned out that, you know, I know this is controversial, but many have claimed that the war was not hastened by the use of the atomic weapons. It was already about to end. I wouldn't be surprised if that was also, I mean, Hitler's armies, the Russians decimated, you know, on the Eastern Front, I think Hitler's armies were already pretty much defeated.
Yeah, you know, I think it's such a complicated question. I mean, I think the firebombing in Germany killed more people than the nuclear bombs in Japan did. I think they had a higher fatality and casualty rate. I think it had a sort of unintended effect from everything that I've read among the Germans in that it made them fight even harder for their devastated city. So that when the Allies came through on the ground, they found almost a sort of insane level of resistance in some cities, including the city of Würzburg, which, you know, you had children and elderly men fighting for every sort of overturned stone. So I don't know. I mean, I think that is such a hard question, and it's difficult to know whether it hastened things, whether it saved lives. On balance, I don't know. I mean, I think those are hard decisions to make then and even now looking back on it. But the level of destruction, I think, is something that hasn't gotten a lot of attention. I mean, Germany rebuilt all those cities. But my mother's earliest memory, one of her earliest memories, is of her grandfather, of her father, coming back from the city of Würzburg after the train had been bombed. And she remembered his bloody winter coat. You know, I mean, I think it affected just about every German in every city. They either knew someone who had been killed or who'd been injured, or they'd experienced it themselves.
Yeah. And now my final question is about the title. Why The Vanishing Sky?
The Vanishing Sky fits into a very important scene in the book, a flashback scene where Etta is remembering something from her childhood where she and her friends did something that was sort of horrible beyond description, and the sort of notion of morality, of any sort of reference, anything at all is sort of gone. It just seemed to fit. But that scene in particular, I think, is sort of the key to the book in many ways. And that's where it comes from.
It's the key to the book in the sense of the how she confronts her moral failure of that time?
I think so, yes. The sort of notion of, you know, how much guilt is collective guilt? How much do you resist? What happens if you fail to resist? You know, what do you carry with you?
And a very important lesson for today. I mean, couldn't help but read this book through the lens of what's going on now in this country, where it seems that we are on the cusp of either a successful resistance to someone who is really threatening to become an authoritarian leader, dictator, strongman, versus, you know, the threat that we may fail in that resistance.
Well, I mean, I hope that the message is evergreen in that way, you know, that we have to try to act in a way that we won't be ashamed of 10 years from now, 10 months from now. We have to try to do good. And more than anything, we have to be willing to accept differences, because I think Nazism at its core is an ideology that absolutely tried to stamp out differences in race, differences in, you know, sexual orientation, absolutely any sort of difference. And that goes to differences in viewpoint, so that you could not express anything. And I think more than anything, we have to be willing to embrace people for their differences and remain open-minded. And I think that more than anything is a lesson that is relevant now and will always be relevant. And when we fail in doing that, you know, catastrophe can ensue.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you so much, Annette Binder, for talking with us about this absolutely terrific book, this novel, The Vanishing Sky.
Thank you so much, Francesca. It's been a pleasure.
In addition to The Vanishing Sky, Annette Binder is the author of the award-winning collection of stories, Rise. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.